You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR. Daryl's here, the world's second greatest producer.
Well, who's the first?
She's dead.
And she's still better than me.
Well, of course, Daryl.
Oh,
now, no. you got some salacious gossip about Margaret Road Night, eh?
Oh, yes.
What's going on?
Well, I since found out, I looked her up.
You looked her up? What, did you knock on her door?
No, this is all on the internet.
Must be true.
Well, from 1973 to 2023,
yeah,
she released 10 albums singing blues, jazz, gospel and folk.
Yeah.
She was influenced by the likes of Harry Belafonte, yeah, Nina Simone.
Yeah.
In 1977, she travelled and performed across Europe and the US for 6 months.
Yeah.
And in 2018, she won the Lifetime Achievement Award. And I noticed one of the songs she sang was Girls in Our Town. I
That's
thought,
right.
That sounds familiar. So yeah, I looked it up on my computer.
Yeah.
And there she was, smack bang in the middle of my music list with singing that song.
And you never knew about it?
No. No, God, and I never thought it was the same singer as
this,
the intro.
Well, I can tell you, after you read all that bullshit, we interviewed Margaret, and she's on the podcast. And I asked her the question, you must be a rich woman by now. And she said to me, fucking no. She said, it's the people who write the songs who get the money, not the people who sing them.
Yeah, I noticed that. She didn't write anything.
No, and she's still out there in her 80s doing gigs.
Yeah,
to keep body and soul together. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Well, our poor guest is a bit bored by all this. He's come in with, he's Mr. America, I reckon. I'm not going to out you regarding your shoes, what you're eating and what you're drinking, mate, because we've got an American boycott here, a USA boycott in this studio.
So am I going to be penalised?
There's no point. The fact that you do that you are, you know, a trumpet, you know, you don't need to be penalised. The fact that you are one of them, that is your penalty.
And I dressed up especially for this event.
I know you're dressed up. You've got every corporate brand on you just to piss me off.
Just like a professional tennis player.
Yeah.
We get sponsored.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, we better introduce you, mate. Look, Daryl's got trouble pronouncing your name. I think I can pronounce it, but let's do it properly. What's on your birth certificate?
Andonis Kyriakou.
Does Andonis mean God?
No, that's Adonis.
Adonis.
It gets mixed up quite often.
Does it?
To my great annoyance.
Why are you annoyed?
Because, you know, Adonis reminds me of a porn star's name.
Right. What, a 70s porn star's name?
Yeah, the ones with those, you know, mustaches. And all
mustaches. Oh, yeah. Well, he hasn't got a mustache, listeners. No. The program is going to be podcast, isn't it, Daryl?
Yep.
Yeah, so sure we can actually see what he looks like. You've taken a photo already, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Yes.
I reckon he'd be perfect for those, you know, those dartboards. You put it over the dartboard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What do you reckon?
Oh, we're not.
Tony. We'll call you Tony, mate. We'll call you Tony.
Call me Tony.
Yeah.
Look, I, you know, having worked in the corporate world for 30-odd years, I'm sure I'm on many dartboards.
Yeah, all right, okay. Yeah. Let's start at the beginning, mate. Where were you born?
I was born in Melbourne.
Melbourne?
Yes, Melbourne, Queen Victoria Hospital.
What?
There are still remnants of that
there
hospital.
There is, yeah. You know why there are remnants?
No, please enlighten.
And you know why it's there?
No.
Why it was initially?
No.
Well, in the 1880s, Melbourne, marvellous Melbourne, became depressed Melbourne. 10% of women in Melbourne were working girls, you know.
Yeah.
In those days, poor contraception. There was a lot of infanticide going on.
Mm-hmm.
And people used to throw their babies in the Yarra.
So things haven't changed.
Well, they have changed. They have changed.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. But what happened is that there was a big debate and the women gathered, they donated a penny, which built the old Queen Victoria Hospital. And then John Cain Jr. privatised it in the 1980s.
Yes.
And then they realised that they couldn't really privatise it because it really wasn't state government property, so they offered the women's movement one little wing, and that's what's still left.
Oh, didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, you learn something every day.
Yeah, I know you're a great fan of the Palestinians. Yeah, there used to be some protest outside a chocolate shop, which I think is still there, an Israeli chocolate shop.
Yes.
And there were a lot of arrests, and a smart lawyer like you realised that the area they were protesting on was public land, and they couldn't be charged for protesting on private land because it had never been gazetted back as private land when it was sold.
So someone made a mistake.
Well, maybe.
An oversight.
An oversight. Yeah. So you're born in Melbourne. Where did your parents come from?
Well, my parents came here in the 50s. Cyprus. Both parents came from Cyprus.
Mm.
And my father met my mother on a W-class tram.
In Melbourne.
Melbourne.
True Melbourne love story.
Yeah, well, back then, when you liked the sight of a girl, you kind of stalked her on a tram. And that's what he did. But these days, that would be
stalking.
Unlawful.
Unlawful, yeah. Unlawful. And but in those days, it was called romance.
Yeah, it was called romance. And things roll on from there. And they got married and had two kids. And they lived in South Melbourne. Yeah. And
as the Cypriots did.
Well, a lot of Cypriots lived in South Melbourne when they came here. Unlike the 10-pound Poms or others who came here for free, my parents had to pay their way. Even though they were Cypriot, they were back in 1956 and 58. They were British subjects, so they had British passports.
Right.
So they had to pay their way full fare. You could buy a house in Melbourne for the amount of money a family paid to travel to Australia.
Did your father leave Cyprus because he was warned off for his own health? Or?
No. That was my grandfather.
Right.
Was a political agitator.
Mm-hmm.
His first cousin was the first president of Cyprus, the Archbishop Makarios.
Yeah, right.
He was also head of the church, the Cypriot Orthodox Church. And my grandfather was a political agitator. The British didn't like him much, but when He got an idea in his head to come to Australia.
Right.
The British were jumping for joy, and they said, "Yes, we'll issue her a visa." And to my grandmother's horror, her name Calliope, she was horrified that A, he wanted to go, and B, the British government gave him one.
Right.
But that enabled him to come to Australia. He came in 1949.
Uh-huh.
He spent 5 or 6 years here.
Yep.
You know, gathering up enough money to buy a house, which he did. He bought two houses, by the way, in South Melbourne.
Right.
You could do that back then, unlike today.
No, that's right.
Everyone needs a house.
You need to give up your kidney to have the deposit for a house in South Melbourne these days.
Oh, it's ridiculous. I still have cousins who still reside there in the family home that they bought in the 50s in South Melbourne.
Yeah,
they have all these tall towers around them.
Yeah,
but
they're just waiting for them to die.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I mean,
so it was your grandfather that came. So how did your parents, they come?
Well, grandfather came in 49. Yeah. He, as I said, saved up a lot of money and bought a house. And then he brought the family over in 56.
Oh, right.
When the Olympics were on.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and my mother went to that secondary school in South Melbourne along City Road.
Oh, yeah.
I can't recall its name, but...
Is that now the McRobertson Girls School?
No.
There's another one, was it?
No, this one's been turned into a library, a functional local community library. I'll remember as we
chat
roll
on.
So then, my father came in 1958. He was they grew tobacco's business. They were farmers up north. They grew tobacco and sold that to British Tobacco every year. Right. But like typical British Tobacco, that, you know, the crop they grew was never first grade.
No.
It was always third grade.
Third grade.
So my father, you know, had enough of that. He goes, look, I don't want to be a farmer, you know. My father's father, and he did really well. I mean, he just kept on investing in property, so he ended up...
The Australian way.
Oh, he had lots of land, you know, and my father had four other siblings.
Mm.
And whenever they were married, when each child was married, the my grandfather would say, look, here's some land and a house.
Yep.
Piss off, don't bother me ever again.
I like it.
So he did that to all the five children, and he did that to my father, Andrew. And back in the 60s, when my father got married to my mum, Maria, he was, and an envelope arrived via special courier. This friend of my grandfather's came over to live in Australia, and he said, well, since you're going over, here's a letter, and there's some other documents in there. And what was in that letter was the title deeds to the property that my grandfather gave my father on marriage.
Right.
Now, this has been witnessed by other people, that when my father opened the letter and read the contents and looked at the properties and knew where they were located, he said, oh, my father doesn't love me. And my mother said, oh, why? And he goes, well, the property's crap. It's shit. You can't grow anything on it. It's all sand. It's on the beach. You can't grow anything on the beach. He doesn't love me. Anyway, fast forward to the year 2010.
Yeah.
I had the property valued at $100 million.
Why did he flog it, did he?
So, no, I have the title deeds now.
Title deeds.
But. But there's always a but.
There's always a but.
Now, as we know, the Turks invaded Cyprus in 1974.
Yep.
They haven't left. So, you know, the Cypriot food, they like the Cypriot food, so they don't leave. That's my take on it.
That's your take on it.
But, you know...
So the property is on the wrong side of the dividing line.
Well, it's in the, as I say, the the occupied zone.
Right.
Or the non-government-controlled territory.
Territories. All right.
So I'm not going to go into this, you know, debate about Greeks and Turks nationalistic bullshit.
Yeah.
Because I don't entertain that, because Cyprus received its independence from Britain in 1960. It's Cyprus. It's not Greek Cyprus or Turkish Cyprus. It's just Cyprus, and there are just Cypriot citizens.
Yeah.
Cypriot citizens who are either Muslim or they are the Christian or other religious denominations. Mm. So I don't discriminate, mm. and that's the way it ought to be. But I can't do anything with the property unless I sell it at such a discounted rate.
Right.
And the going rate is like selling it for 10% of its value. Mm. So instead of 100 million, you end up with 10 million. I can't see myself doing that.
You can't, fair enough. It's more than the money, isn't it?
It is, because that property is its home, its heritage.
Yeah.
And the only way I can describe it is because I went there.
Yep.
It was funny. I've been there quite a few times, but I recall my 2009 visit, whereby I landed on the island, and I took the car from my cousin's place in Limassol to Nicosia. And at Nicosia, there's a border crossing to the occupied north.
Mm.
And there's no specific name for that border crossing, but I named it. I name everything.
What did you name it?
I called it, not unlike, remember when Berlin, they had the Berlin Wall?
And what was
that? Checkpoint Charlie?
Checkpoint Charlie.
Yeah, and I said, well, look, if the Germans can have Checkpoint Charlie, why can't the Cypriots have name their border crossing with the occupied?
Yeah, so what did you call it?
I call it Checkpoint Habib.
Habib.
So I went there, and there was a nice, pleasant guard. Yeah. You can tell he was from mainland Turkey.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice bloke, great bloke. You know, and he asked me, look, you need to pay £20. And I go, £20 for what? sorry, let me correct that, 20 euros.
All right, yep.
Right. And I go, well, that's the fee that we charge to get across to the other side. And I go, what, to see my own property, to go home? And he goes, yes. I go, does everybody pay this, or are there exemptions? Are there carve-outs?
Yeah.
No, you have to pay it.
Right.
So I said, all right. So I reluctantly paid, and I kind of facetiously, with a grin on my face, said, do you want to see my passport?
Yeah.
I go, well, no one recognises this illegitimate regime.
Right.
He goes, no, I go, what do you mean, no? Aren't you going to stamp my passport? Because I love to see your stamp. And he goes, no, we don't stamp the passport. I go, oh, that's interesting. Right. So what do you do? I stamp a piece of paper.
Right.
So he pulls out this half foolscap piece of paper with some writing on it and stamps that.
Yeah.
I go, oh. You know, what a gig. What a gig.
Look, we're going to need to move on, mate. We could go on this forever.
Yeah.
Now, so you grew up in Melbourne. What suburb?
Well, I grew up first in Hawthorne.
All right.
Just up the road, just around the corner from Glen Ferry Oval, where the Hawks had their home ground. And across the road from the Glen Ferry Oval, there was a tennis club and called Grace Park.
Right.
Yes. So we were amongst the sporting district of Hawthorne.
Mm.
Yeah. And we were there for 4 years of my life since birth, and then moved to Hampton. Been there ever since.
Yeah. So what, did you go to Hampton schools, did you?
Yeah, so I went to Hampton Primary.
Mm-hmm.
That was nice. and then went to Hampton High. Hated Hampton High, to be honest.
Any particular reason?
Oh, yes. The teachers, tall poppy syndrome. I was an academic back then.
Oh, right.
I was more focused on having a sporty career.
Oh, right.
Playing tennis.
Uh-huh.
And I was hell-bent on getting on the circuit and also representing Australia. That was another story.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I love Hampton. It's got a nice beach. I was down there 3 days ago.
All right.
Motoring around on my Australian design, Australian made mobility wheelchair.
Excuse me. Hang on. I'm a bit confused. So what happened to put you in a mobility wheelchair, and how old were you?
I was 17.
You were 17, yeah.
Oh, I had a brother who was a...
Oops. Right.
Yeah, you stepped on that one.
Yeah, let's move on.
Yeah, but anyway, because of him, I wouldn't categorise it as an accident.
Let's say your life changed dramatically.
Yeah, from being sporty and athletic to being a patient at the Austin Hospital for several months.
In the spinal injuries unit.
Yes. That's where I met you, I think. Was it? You were the... a registrar?
I could have been.
Admitting registrar?
I could have been admitting registrar, yeah. I don't know if I recollect you, Tony. I mean, you know, you're only a kid, weren't you? 16, 17?
I remember, yeah, I was 17. Yeah. I recollect this because I found it funny.
Right.
People used, back then, there were these chocolate bars called Toscas.
That's right, yeah.
And your name is kind of similar.
That's right, yeah. And Toscano,
Toscano, Toscas.
Yeah.
We amongst the
captives.
At that time, from what I recollect, there were an unusual amount of young cripples passing through the spinal unit at Austin
there were.
Hospital.
At one stage, we had 100 in 1 year, which was extraordinary.
Yes, and anyway, and most were going to be walkers. And what they mean by walkers in inverted commas is that trouble.
Yeah.
In other words, these people will talk back, walk back, and do whatever they like.
Yeah.
So I was amongst that group of troublemakers.
Mm.
But I must say, look, the Austin Hospital is a great place. A great place, a great spinal unit. They had care and compassion, and they did a lot for the patient to get them to be up, standing up and being mobile.
Mm.
The allied staff, the physios and OTs, were fantastic. And the doctors, the clinicians, they were fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
And you were amongst them.
Yeah, I was one of them, at that stage. We were much, much younger then, weren't we?
Yes.
Much, much, much younger, and we were sporting, as they say, fit, healthy. Because the thing is, when you break your neck, you're healthy. People don't realise that. You're healthy.
You're not sick.
No.
No, you're not sick.
In the majority of cases, you're not sick. You lose the function of your hands, you lose the function of your bladder, your bowel, your legs, but you don't feel sick. You just feel helpless.
Yeah, and... With me at the time, it was like paralysed from the neck down. You couldn't move anything from the neck down, and the prognosis wasn't great.
No.
It was like I remember Dr. Gerald Unger.
Yeah, the late Gerald Unger.
Yeah, yeah, I love Gerald. He was a great clinician.
You know, he was one of the children who was put on a train from Vienna as the Nazis came in. He was on the last train to England. Jewish, really? Jewish, one of the Jewish lads who was put on the train.
Yep.
Parents left behind. He lost his parents in the Holocaust.
Wow.
And he made his way in life, yeah. He actually worked with Gutenberg, who was the initiator of the clinical hope amongst people with spinal cord injuries. But before that, people would die within 6 to 12 months.
Yep.
So, yeah, he was a great human being. He's buried in the Jewish cemetery down at Mulgrave.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
If you ever want to go and throw a rock at his headstone, he's there.
Well, I wouldn't throw a rock.
That's a mark of respect.
Is that what you do?
Well, you throw a rock in that, on the coffin.
Okay. All right.
At the funeral, which I thought was a bit unusual, but who am I to question other people's cultural beliefs? Yeah. So here you are. You had this sporting career. You're a great tennis player. You're going to go on the Australian circuit, to the international circuit, and all of a sudden it's all gone. What did you do?
Well, I was, I, from what I can recall, this is really important, is that there was this orderly, I'm trying to recall his name. Anyway, there was this orderly who was great there, and I was sitting on the edge of my bed, and I remember it was a sunny day, and I was facing the windows of old Ward 17.
Mm.
And Lindsay Knight, that was his name, he had a bellowing voice. He knew I was trouble. But anyway, that day he saw me there at the edge of the bed, and he came up and I said to him, I don't know what to do. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, I think you know what you're going to do. And I go, yeah, I think I know. So I knew my other fallback position was to go back to school and then go to high school, then go to university. I said, that's a plan.
Mm-hmm.
Not long before that, I watched a movie,
yep.
An American movie.
Yep.
It was called Animal House. And it was people, you know, university students living in dormitories and so forth, and it looked fun.
Yeah.
And I go, I want to do that. I want to be Pluto. So there I was. I did HSC, and I passed. Wasn't great. Well, given that, couldn't write.
That's right. Couldn't use your hands. That's
couldn't
right.
use my hands.
Yeah.
Energy was gone.
Yeah.
You know.
Hmm.
My whole other life had to be buried, you know.
Yeah.
And awake.
Yeah.
And all that. So it wasn't great. But anyway, we passed. And even though I remember at the Austin Hospital, there was a head of the spinal unit, a Dr. Brown, another great, great clinician, said to me, you must take the year off. You won't be able to do your HSC. You're physically impossible.
Mm.
Can't do it. I go, well, I've got up and I'm walking, aren't I? You got that wrong. Can't see this being any different.
Yeah.
So I gave it a go, I passed, you know, and got into university. I didn't apply to any universities in Victoria. That's a personal issue, but
yeah.
I applied New South Wales, Canberra, Tasmania, got into a few, and chose, after flying down to Hobart to have a look at University of Tasmania, I thought, and speaking to some of the university staff, I thought, yeah, this is a great place.
Mm-hmm.
Let me have a look at the residential college.
He's thinking of Animal House, yeah.
Yeah. So Jane Franklin Hall was, I went there and I said, this looks like fun. I go, well, this is where I will come.
Right.
So I had an interview with the principal of the college. It was another great bloke, David Daintree. And he gave me the nod.
Mm.
And so I registered at the university in science and was given an opportunity to reside at Jane Franklin Hall, an independent university college.
No.
And to this very day, it still is independent. And it's a great institution.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
It's interesting that you actually haven't mentioned the course you did. You're more interested in the college.
Oh, yeah, I had more fun. The course science was secondary. It wasn't important.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So I just loved Jane Franklin Hall and O Week and all that. It was lots of alcohol and... Young university students.
Yeah, the great thing about alcohol and being paralytic, you were halfway there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, put it this way. Well, when I worked as a corporate lawyer,
yeah,
and I worked in the medical research field,
uh-huh,
I'm not going to name
the
institution.
No.
Some of the researchers slash clinicians will say on a Friday afternoon, so what are you doing this Saturday, Mr. Kiriakou? And I said, well, I'll be practicing a little bit of Saturday night palsy. And you look, they had a blank look
on
their face.
Yeah, no idea.
Can't you take a joke? And anyway, so moving on. Going back to college, it was great. I just loved the social events.
When did you move from science to law?
Well, I did 2 years of science.
Yeah.
And I was majoring in maths and physics and marine biology. You had to do that. Because Tasmania, the wilderness state, you know, to see Tasmania and the wilderness for free, you just got to enrol in marine biology or some life science course. And you get to go out there in fast boats, helicopters, four-wheel drives, places where you just can't do it yourself.
Right.
So that was the motivation.
But how did that spill over into law?
Well, there was this professor of science, Professor Michael Stoddart. I love Michael. He's great, honest. He actually, you know, he's an incomplete quadriplegic.
Himself, huh?
No, myself.
Yeah, I know.
But Michael didn't discriminate.
No.
There's a lot of prejudice out there.
Yeah.
Joe.
Did you find any on the train here?
There's always prejudice on the train.
Right.
But there's a lot of prejudice in the corporate world, but that's another topic.
Yeah.
But Michael, whilst doing my HSC, there was a lot of prejudice during high school, you know, against a person living with a disability. Enormously so. But I thought that would roll over to university. It did, but it was checkered in that some departments were great, very helpful, others less so. And where Michael was great in that he'd get me out there. Like he'll help me onto a Zodiac.
Right.
And from a Zodiac onto a twin hull catamaran boat.
That's not easy because you're very stiff.
Yeah.
You know, it's not easy standing up. You're just like a, you know.
A cigar really, stick.
Yeah, really stiff. I can imagine what a Zodiac tipping over into the ocean, mate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he didn't discriminate. He was very helpful. So I wasn't left out.
Right.
I was included.
Mm.
And it's all about inclusion.
Yeah.
And so anyway, to answer your question is that Michael, I once sat in Michael's office one day and we were chewing the fat amongst the different animal skull heads, like gorillas and tigers and whatnot. And he said, "You know, Tony?" And I said, "Yes. Yes, Michael." And he goes, "You know, you should do law." I kind of looked at him and I said, "That's a good idea. That'll add another 3 or 4 years to my, you know, imprisonment in Tasmania."
Mania. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
A voluntary imprisonment.
Oh, yeah.
Enjoyable imprisonment.
Yeah, yeah, enjoyable. Yeah. Enjoyable. Yeah. So I did that and I took his advice and enrolled, went and saw the Dean of Law, who at the time, I'm not going to mention his name, but he was a very horrible person.
Right. The only people who mention their name is the nice ones. That's
nice. Yeah, definitely.
That's good. Yeah, yeah. But being a corporate lawyer, you understand defamation, obviously.
Well, I'm not being nasty. I'm just being honest.
Right.
But the thing is, there's no maliciousness there. But I'm just being honest, telling the
truth. They did. They did let you enroll.
Well, he did say this. Tasmanian-born
professor,
Dean, who used to sail a lot. he said to me, "With crippled hands, you can't write much. Really, you're not going to. You wouldn't be able to practice law. So, what's the point of enrolling?"
Mm.
So I kind of looked at him and said, "Oh, look. To be honest, I have dragon dictate, number one." I go, "Do you know what that is?" And he goes, "No." I said, "Oh, look, I'll enlighten you. It's a voice recognized computer application that types for you.
Mm.
So don't you worry yourself about that."
You sound like Bjelke Petersen. "Don't you worry yourself about that."
Yes. Well, you had to grow up fast.
Yeah, so you completed law.
Yeah, so but I met other great professors.
Right.
There. He was my major obstacle, but right. Martin Semeny, Professor Tim McCormack, the great Don Chalmers, all those people were very helpful towards me, as well as many others down the law school. They were supportive and inclusive, and I got a law degree.
Yeah, and you said you've been working in the corporate world for decades.
Well, put it this way, I started off being a prosecutor for the Commonwealth DPP.
Yeah, yeah.
So please, you know. you know,
we that, all make mistakes.
Yeah, it was a mistake.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go into that because they have long memories.
That's right.
And are well connected. Anyway, so let's leave them aside. But then after being there for 2 years or so and arguing matters on my feet, I thought I was proficient in court and very, you know, articulate and, you know, so forth. And I decided, no, I don't want to go down this path. You know, I'll want to be an in-house corporate lawyer. So that's where I was focused. And all my jobs since then were in-house.
What does that mean? What is an in-house? What is an in-house corporate lawyer?
Well, an in-house lawyer is someone who works within an organisation who manages legal risk.
Right.
And what I was specialised in is drafting contracts, putting large transactions together. And working with the board and also executive management. So I worked in various areas of the law. I specialised in resources law, like renewable energy and mining. But I've worked in the water industry for water retailers as a general counsel. I've worked in mining companies. I've worked in other fields as well. So I've worked across the board in sort of like in the banking industry and also medical research as a general counsel. So it's been quite broad. So if you want to describe my in-house legal experience, it's broad generalist.
Right. Yes. And was this satisfying work?
It was. When I became a general counsel or the chief legal officer of the organisation, you were in a senior managerial position advising boards or senior managers, and I found that satisfying. It's all like doing that. I was in my own element. I found what I was put on this planet to do, you know, as a job.
Did your physical limitations have any impact?
No, none whatsoever, other than prejudice, because I had to fight prejudice on a daily basis. It's not, I didn't have the problem. I don't have the problem. Right. Never had the problem. The thing is, you have ableists who have an innate prejudice problem against someone who is different. The only way to describe it further is that they have a fear of the unknown, of someone who is different. And all the bad stuff comes out.
Wow.
And as a person who's lived through that for 43 years, I've worked, you know, I've developed techniques to manage that and deal with it. It's mainly education. But having said that, education can only get you so far with someone who's prejudiced. If their mindset is set in concrete to be prejudiced, no matter what you do or say, won't change things. So sometimes you just have to move on.
Right.
And say, well, look, this is too difficult for me. I'm not going to waste my time.
Yeah.
Because we're only on this planet for a short time.
That's right. Yeah, I think anybody who suffers a catastrophic injury in an instant and their life changes in an instant has a great understanding of the how short life is and how life can change dramatically. I find that I've only dealt with spinal cord injuries for the last, 45 years, and I find that in most of the people I've been involved with in a medical capacity, that instant changes everything. It gives them a fresh insight, you know, into what's important in life. Now, I understand, if I remember correctly, you had a famous case against some airline company?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that, because that seems to be a perennial problem.
Yeah.
What year was it?
Oh, that was 2001.
Right.
And this is when, Not Qantas, but the other airline.
The one that's...
the other domestic airline.
The one that's bankrupt now, that's dead.
No, it's still around.
Oh, still around. Okay, go on.
It was given some money.
Oh, right.
You know, it was called corporate philanthropy.
It's called? Yeah. It's a hedge fund philanthropy.
Anyway, I flew to Sydney. I was up there for 4 days doing work. And I flew up with the airline. It was the first time I flew with them. I always flew Qantas, and I love Qantas because they always do the right thing by me. Love them to bits.
I won't ask how many shares you own in the company.
I own zero shares.
Right.
So, but I love them. Anyway, so I flew up with the other airline, and it was kind of okay. A lot of theatrical trolley dolly stuff, which really wasn't warranted. But anyway, on the way back, I went to the counter and to get my boarding pass, and the lady behind the counter at this airline made these negative derogatory comments. Anyway, I proceeded, and they were reluctant to put me on the plane. And anyway, I stood up in front of so many people there at the gate lounge. It was a shed back then in 2001, and so there was about 400 people there.
Mm.
When I stood up and said, "Please, ladies and gentlemen, please take note of what's transpiring," you could hear a pin drop, and everyone took notice. And there were two federal policemen with big guns. And I did whisper to him and said, "Yeah, I used to be a prosecutor for the Commonwealth. I know you guys. And they quickly go, they ran away because they said, "Uh-oh, this guy's a good guy. We're in the wrong place." Anyway, the Virgin staff made some derogatory comments. And anyway, I was allowed on the plane, put on the plane. I sat down and the captain came walking down. It was his prerogatory. He goes, "I don't want you on the plane." I go, "Fine, can you please get me my briefcase up there and give it to me and I'll get off your plane."
Mm.
I knew aviation law. I was a prosecutor.
Yeah.
Prosecuted those. Yeah, you were
kind of funneling them into the corral.
Yeah.
corral.
Anyway, I was frog marched off the plane as an incomplete quad, and they were pushing me really hard, and I tripped over on the tarmac. And there I lay for an hour, and fire crew, ambulance came. Anyway, cut a long story short. They offered me a cab charge to get to wherever I was. And I thought about it for a minute, and I said, "I could take this cab charge all the way to Melbourne." And I said, "Oh, shit, I've got work in Melbourne. It'll take me 10 hours or 12. So I refused, and anyway, I was dragged. They threw all my gear off the plane, and I was dragging it Sydney Airport.
Yeah.
I was dragging it along, and then this ambulance crew came past and they said, "Look, we can give you a lift." And I go, "What, to the Qantas lounge? Because that's where I'm going to get a ticket." So they said, "Yeah, okay." So they chucked my gear in and I sat in the back of the ambulance and they took me up the ramp there, the departure.
Yeah.
Lounge at Qantas. I went there and the guy goes, "I know you." And I go, "Yeah, I've been coming to Sydney for the last 4 months every month." And he said, I need a plane to get back home." He goes, "One's departing in 20 minutes, but we'll hold it up for you."
Right.
That's how good Qantas was.
Yeah.
I told them about what happened with the other airline and they said, "Yeah, no worries." So they held up the plane, took my luggage on board the plane because they had already locked the cargo. And got me back to Melbourne. And then when I was in Melbourne, I was told, take him to court, which I did. And to cut a long story short, we went, the jury was seconded for 12 days in the Supreme Court.
12 days?
12 days, yeah. It's going to be a lot of, we were going to burn a lot of kanga.
All right.
And the law firm at that time that represented me was Holding and Redlich. And the McGarvey boys were my lawyers, both solicitor and barrister. And their father was Chief Justice at one time of the Victorian Supreme Court. And later, if you recall, Joe, Governor of Victoria.
That's right, yep.
So anyway, we got to court and the judge seconded the jury and the judge goes, well, look, I'll give you one last go now. Go to your respective corners. I'll give you 2 hours, try and settle it, or otherwise we're on for 12 rounds. Anyway, we did. I said, look, you know, I want this, they want that. We came to some kind of arrangement where everyone was kind of happy. To be honest, I just wanted it all to go away. Yeah. I was trying to prove a point in that, you know, you can't false imprison someone and discriminate against someone. I need to stand up not only for myself, but to the brotherhood of cripples out there that have suffered. Despite all of that, I read in the papers today and every other day that people in wheelchairs, no matter who they fly with, are still treated abominably.
Yeah, I've had a number of patients have to take legal action in the last 20 years. It never changes. I don't understand.
I tell you, it's the corporate prejudice.
Never
as
changes.
I said, unless you want to change, they will not change.
No.
And that's something that people like myself will have to fight until they put us in the ground in a box.
You know,
it's unfortunate. But the only way I can see things changing in that respect is if some government of whatever persuasion decides to be serious about implementing good law that protects our human rights. Unless that happens, we're just pushing shit uphill. And we'll do that forever. Look, it's all about being genuine. And as far as I'm concerned, in the last 12 years, governments have not been genuine, because otherwise they would have pushed through law that would have changed our lives for the better. They keep, I can't comprehend or understand why people living with a disability, don't have laws to protect their human rights and their dignity. It is one of those thorns in my side that will continue because I have no confidence in government today in fixing that.
Well, in many regards, as you realise, being a barrister and solicitor and a corporate lawyer, that there's no human rights in the Australian Constitution. So maybe one bridge too far away, as they say.
It is.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is. I just hope, but let me just say this. I'm not in the wishful thinkers club.
Right.
There's too many cripples out there that are in this club. And I hate them. Because as long as you're in that club, nothing happens. You don't think, you just do. And that's what governments need to
understand.
Do.
do. Yeah, if you don't look, even if you struggle initially and you're ineffective, the fact that you're struggling is, you know, is a point that you're making. You don't have to be effective initially. It just takes time.
Joe, I've had 43 years of being an incomplete quadriplegic.
Yeah,
I've seen prejudice at high school. Mm. I've seen prejudice at uni. I've seen prejudice whilst working. It's 43 years. Mm. It has not gone away.
No.
It's like a bad smell.
Mm.
And you know what? The thing about prejudice is that a lot of these ableist people that you work with, they think they're funny.
Right.
But they're not. But I think they're... but sometimes I sit back and say, well, I feel like all you guys are funny because you're all the same. You're no different. Anyway.
Anyway, so look, we've got about a minute or two while you're swigging that drink from what is a great addition to your wheelchair.
Yes. And the other brands.
And the other brands that you brought in. You wanted to shame us, you know, show us that you're a pro-American patriot, obviously.
Look, I won't let you down. If you do invite me back, next time when I do attend, I will pull out my sticky tape.
The sticky tape.
The coloured sticky tape.
Coloured sticky tape.
And cover up.
All
the corporate brand.
The corporate brand. Now, in the last minute, we say, when we were chatting before we came into the studio, you said you're a great supporter of the Palestinian cause.
Yes, definitely.
Why?
Why? Because it's 100 years since Palestine was liberated by the Australian infantry in World War II from the Ottomans.
Ottomans, that's right. Right. Turks, yeah.
Right. And what gets up my goat is when I go to a Caulfield Park and I see the local community there saying that the Australian infantry in World War II freed Israel from the Ottomans. There's a brass plate that says that is incorrect. It's freed Palestine.
Mm.
And the thing I want, in addition to that, it's it finally they're recognised, and they need to be recognised.
Mm. Thank you very much, Tony. Thank you very much, Daryl. And obviously you'll be podcasting this chat.
Yes, yep.
Yeah. Thank you for taking public transport and showing me the addition to your wheelchair to make a great stubby holder. It looks like a stubby holder. Is it a stubby holder?
It is a stubby holder.
Right.
Do you expect anything less from an Australian design and Australian manufactured wheelchair?
Nope. Stubby holder. Thank you, Daryl. We better wind up.
Okay. You have been listening to Radical Australia with presenter Joe Toscano and special guest Andonis Kyriakou.
It's Kyriakou.
Kyriakou.
Kyriakou, thanks.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. The god. Kyriakou the god. Okay?
Okay.
Commonly known, a.k.a. as Tony.
A.k.a.
Stay tuned now for Brainwaves coming right up.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.